Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump begins. Today, senators will be asked to consider whether to convict the former president of incitement of insurrection. The prosecution, led by Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin, will argue that Trump's claims of election fraud and the ways he encouraged his supporters to challenge the results sowed the seeds for what unfolded on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. On the other side, the defense will say a former president cannot be impeached and that Trump's words are protected by the First Amendment. So, what can we expect? I spoke with David Preece, Chief Operating Officer at the Lawfare Institute and author of How to Get Rid of a President. David, the second impeachment trial of President Trump begins today. Talk about and remind us exactly what former President Trump is being impeached for.
Thank you, Diane. And it's a pleasure to talk with you about this, even on such a solemn occasion of the second impeachment trial of a president. As opposed to the first impeachment and trial of Donald Trump, which was for actions regarding interactions with Ukraine that related to his re-election, this one is solely a domestic matter. This one is about the incitement of insurrection against the legislative branch of the U.S. government and the counting of the electoral votes in the U.S. Congress. Now, the impeachment brief, as filed by the House impeachment managers, wraps a lot into that. But fundamentally, they call it dereliction of duty because the president did not respond to this act as it was occurring. And they have evidence in there from the public record, from his tweets and statements saying that he encouraged this violence, that during the violence, he did nothing to stop it, and afterwards did not show remorse for his role in the violence. All of that, the House impeachment managers will argue, is cause for the president to be disqualified from future office, which is the punishment for a former official who is impeached and has already left office, as of course Donald Trump has.
We have a new president in office, Joe Biden. Americans presumably are moving on from former President Donald Trump. So, in your view, why is this impeachment necessary?
The logic is that a president would essentially get a free pass in the final days and weeks, perhaps months of his presidency, if there is no penalty for high crimes and misdemeanors, treason, or bribery that occurs during that time. It is possible that the U.S. Congress could quickly hold an impeachment hearing and then move it to the Senate for a trial. Existing rules make it difficult to expedite that, but it could be done. But even in this case, where there was violence inside the U.S. Capitol building, it still took a while to get that process going. If you cannot have a trial of a president who has committed high crimes and misdemeanors in the waning days of his presidency, that's essentially a get-out-of-jail-free card to do anything that the president wants at the end because there is no punishment. And let's be clear, there is the possibility, I will admit, of political impeachments, that is, impeachments that focus on policy differences that the opponents take to such an extreme that they will chase someone down and do an impeachment over that. We haven't seen much of that in our history. Some people claim the Bill Clinton impeachment was an extension of policy differences, but clearly there was also some perjury and other activities going on from the president. But in this case, this is as far removed as you can get from that. This was the president denying the results of the election, building up even before the election to have supporters fight it. using every means at his disposal to overturn the results of the election, and then speaking to a crowd that he had mobilized to march on the Capitol. That is the kind of behavior that, if it is not punishable in a Senate trial, it raises the question, well, then what is?
So, as we've said, this is the second impeachment of former President Donald Trump. How, if at all, will this presentation be different from that which went before during the charges about his activities with Ukraine?
It will be different, and in some important ways. First of all, it will be more emotional than the first impeachment trial, because the people sitting in the trial to judge the president's actions here were the victims of this assault. That is, some of them were in the building during the attack and felt that they were personally threatened and perhaps their lives were at risk. That is different than the other impeachment trials in American history. We have not had a case where the senators sitting in judgment of the president were ones that felt attacked by the president's own actions, not in a political sense, but in a physical sense. Usually the senators sit very seriously, grim-faced, listening to the testimony in an impeachment trial. There are rules that there are not allowed to be outbursts or exclamations. This trial, we may actually see, if the cameras show us, more emotion on the faces and more reactions from the senators than normal, simply because of the fact that this will bring back some very understandable stress for some of them. So that's one way. Another way it will be different is that it almost certainly will be shorter than the first impeachment trial of Donald Trump. As of yesterday, there had been a decision that both sides, both the House impeachment managers and the president's defenders, would have 16 hours each to make their cases. And then there could be a motion for witnesses from the House impeachment managers if they so choose. It is possible this trial could be over in a matter of days rather than a matter of several weeks. It is still unclear at this point how that will play out, because the big question overhanging all of this, Diane, is will they call witnesses? And that's something that is not entirely certain at this point, and it may depend on how things go in the first couple of days of the trial.
If they were to call witnesses, if either side were to call witnesses, who might those witnesses actually be?
Yeah, looking at the briefs that were submitted to the Senate in advance of the trial, it certainly appears that the House impeachment managers have several things they want to demonstrate. One is the activity of the president before the election, talking about how he refused to accept, he refused to say that he would accept the results of the election if it didn't turn out his way, how he was prepping his base for the fact that this election is already rigged against me, with no evidence on that front. They also want to argue that after the election, he tried to overturn the results that went against him using things like phone calls, using things like Twitter, and using conversations. And then they want to show that he exhorted the crowd, he brought them to Washington, he wanted them to walk to the Capitol, and he used language that certainly encouraged violence, even if he did not say the words, "I want you to physically attack the vice president and the senators." They have all of that that they want to show. Now, most of that is already public information. We have the president's tweets. We have a recorded conversation, which the president's lawyers do not deny the accuracy of the president talking to a Georgia state official, asking him to find votes after there had already been audits and other means taken. Almost everything in this is already there, and there's no need for witnesses. But the one element of their argument that could use witnesses, they claim that during the actual attack on the Capitol building, the president in the White House was gleeful. He was celebrating this fact that the Capitol was being stormed, and reporting suggested that he was unhappy with his aides at the White House because they were not as excited as he was about what was happening. That all comes from reporting in the newspapers, from unnamed sources that went to reporters and told them this happened. Those are the kinds of things that could lead to witnesses. You could imagine them calling as a witness former White House officials who were in that room when the president reportedly did and said those things. Some people will argue that that is important because you're showing the state of mind of the president, showing that not only did he have no remorse, but he was gleeful about this attack upon the very U.S. government that he had sworn to defend and preserve. On the other hand, you could make the case that there's enough in the public record to show the actions that were impeachable, and fighting to get witnesses in there to talk about exactly what the president said and did during that time on January 6th would be overkill and not worth the effort.
So you're arguing that the former president himself, while in office, could be his own worst witness by virtue of the films, the statements, the recordings that we already have.
That's right. And it goes back to a debate that many of us watching the president and the institution of the presidency have had over the last 4 years. Some people would argue, well, the president shouldn't be on Twitter saying and doing these things. And we shouldn't be paying attention to his press conferences because his documented lies are so many. And other people said, on the other hand, how would the American people know the lies if we're not watching those? And if you cut off the Twitter account, you're cutting off the way that he is, in fact, you know, burying himself politically by showing his state of mind and by talking about his reasoning and by claiming that the election is a fraud over and over again, despite all of the evidence to the contrary. So you're right. The president's own public actions and words are the very strongest evidence against him. That does set it somewhat apart from the first impeachment and trial. Yes, we had the transcript of what he called the perfect phone call with the Ukrainian president, and that did show inappropriate behavior. But there was a complicated story behind it about relations between Russia and Ukraine and the United States, and when aid was withheld and when it was released, and was it done for solely a political purpose or not? That's a complicated story. This story, by contrast, is not very complicated. You can look in perhaps 15 minutes, House impeachment managers could lay out all of the major facts of the case and perhaps show a video of the president and of the Capitol building and rest their case. They won't do so. They will take more time to build in some of the facts and some of the constitutional arguments here. But it is a much simpler case than the one a year ago.
What about the question of the constitutionality of impeaching a former president?
Yeah, there is some question about impeaching a former president, but we need to be very clear that despite that rhetoric floating around, this is not the impeachment of a former president. The president, when he was president, was impeached. And that is clearly within the rights of the House of Representatives, according to the Constitution. Then the issue becomes, can you have a trial for an impeached president? Absolutely. The Senate leaves no doubt that you can have a trial for an impeached president. Can you have a trial for an impeached president who is now a former president? Well, that is not explicitly mentioned in the Constitution, and the vast majority of constitutional scholars who have written and talked about this of late have argued, well, of course it's not in the Constitution because it's obvious. You would obviously be able to have a trial of an impeached officer in the final days of office who then leaves, because otherwise it renders moot the whole idea of impeachment for actions near the end of a term of office. And I do think, Diane, it is telling that in the president's defense brief that was just released within the last day or two, that they repeatedly cite Brian Cult, a law professor at Michigan State University, who wrote a very lengthy, comprehensive examination of the trials and impeachments of former officers. And in that article, he lays out the arguments on both sides of the case and then analyzes them and says, the weight of the evidence goes towards the fact that, of course, it's okay to try a former official who has been impeached. But the president's defense brief cites his article over and over again as proof that you cannot try an impeached former president. And he has taken some umbrage at this, saying, it's not fair to selectively quote my article or read something into it that's not there, to the point that on the very pages they cite, sometimes he makes the opposite argument that they are claiming. That exposes the weakness of the president's defense that it is simply unconstitutional somehow to hold the trial for this impeachment.
I think we should be clear that all of the actions of which the president is being accused and charged with took place while he was president and between the time that the election took place, deciding that Joe Biden had won, and the time of the inauguration, during which time Donald Trump was still president up until noon on the 20th of January.
Absolutely. It is possible to imagine that if President Trump, let's say, calls a press conference today and goes out and says abhorrent things and says, of course, I ordered the attack on the Capitol and I would do it again and I'm proud of it and I have no remorse for the deaths that occurred on that day, you could imagine that the House impeachment managers would bring that in to the testimony. But as of now, they don't. As of now, it's all about the actions up until Inauguration Day. And frankly, that's what they need because that's what he was impeached for. So yes, it could show the state of mind of the president if he now admits that he had meant it all along, if he's referring back to his own thoughts and actions at the time. But it is certainly unnecessary for the impeachment article the way it is written.
I am interested in going back to that dreadful day on January 6th when the Capitol was indeed invaded and assaulted. Republicans, as well as Democrats, were in the Capitol at the time. There were shouts of something like string up Pence, hang Pence. Other Republicans were under siege as well as Democrats. So I am really baffled as to how they could regard the siege that occurred as not having anything to do with former President Trump's words and actions.
I think you're right on that. And it is reflected in the difference in the impeachment vote that just occurred as opposed to all previous impeachment votes. You have only once before in history had members of a president's party in the House of Representatives vote for an impeachment article. And this was in the Clinton administration. You had a few Democrats who voted for the impeachment articles against Bill Clinton, but it was only a few. In the previous impeachment of Andrew Johnson, there were none. In the first impeachment of Donald Trump, there were none. For this impeachment vote, there were 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach a president of their own party. Yes, that 10 is a very small percentage of all of the House Republicans. That is undeniable. But it is a very hard thing to get a member of the president's own party to vote to impeach that president. And that did happen. You have had some representatives, such as Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, speaking out frequently and quite clearly about the importance of country over party in this case and the fact that he could do nothing else but vote for impeachment and advocate for the conviction of the president. It is unclear to me whether senators are listening, Republican senators in particular, are listening to their counterparts in the House of Representatives. But to the extent that their minds are not already made up because of some partisan loyalty, they really need to consider those words, because there is nothing political, nothing based on party in the words of someone like Adam Kinzinger. He makes a constitutional argument about the merits of a conviction in this case. And I do believe there will be more Republican senators than just Mitt Romney, who in the last impeachment was the only senator of a president's own party to vote for conviction. I believe Mitt Romney will not be alone in this time.
Mitch McConnell is a question. He's kind of baffling in terms of his statements thus far. What do you make of that?
It's hard to get inside someone else's mind, but looking at his long track record in the Senate, it's hard to imagine Mitch McConnell getting out far ahead of his own caucus. That is to say, if you have a groundswell of Republican senators suddenly looking like they're going to convict, then it would be easy to imagine Mitch McConnell joining them and using his efforts to bring along the one or two that he knows he could to have a unified majority of Republican senators going along with it. Something short of that, something like a Senator Romney, a Senator Murkowski, perhaps a Senator Collins and a Senator Toomey, if they all vote to convict, but the vast majority of the Republican senatorial caucus does not, I would find it hard to believe that Mitch McConnell will individually vote to convict. The other question underlying your question is, what will Mitch McConnell be doing behind the scenes? Not just his vote, but will he be doing anything behind the scenes to either rally people against conviction, as he appeared to do in the first impeachment, or to silently encourage people to vote for conviction? And I don't know on that question. I doubt it's the latter. I do suspect that he's not actively advocating for a conviction, but I sure am not hearing any signs that he is actively lobbying or using the power at his disposal as Senate Majority Leader, and now as just leader of the Republicans in the Senate, to compel people to vote against conviction and acquit the president. I'm not hearing that. I think he is leaving it largely up to the conscience of each senator, which may be a scary prospect for some, but at least in this case, they may be more open to listening to the presentations than they would be alternatively.
More of my conversation with David Priest after we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with David Priest. He is Chief Operating Officer at the Lawfare Institute, a Senior Fellow at the Michael V. Hayden Center for Intelligence at George Mason University, and author of How to Get Rid of a President. I want to go back for just a moment to the question of witnesses, and if either side were to call witnesses, who might they be? Who might the Democrats call? Who might Republicans call?
If the point is to demonstrate how serious the attack was, then I could imagine the impeachment managers calling forward some of the representatives themselves, perhaps Capitol Police. They could try to call a senator as a witness. That would be an odd move and a bold move, because they are also sitting in judgment of the president. I'm not sure they will do that, Diane. The record is so clear in the video evidence of what occurred on that day. I am not sure that the president's defense team has the gumption to try to argue that this was fake video somehow, that a police officer was not killed or something like that. I don't see that happening. Therefore, the witnesses go more towards the presidential thoughts and actions side rather than the activities of January 6th themselves. And if the public record of the tweets and the phone calls isn't enough, then yes, the House impeachment managers could try to call someone like the former White House chief of staff or others who were around the president on that day and compel them to say what the president said and did to establish that the president was not just saying these things publicly, but yes, in private, he was saying the same things and hoping that this would happen. I could imagine that. It's harder to imagine on the president's side what witnesses they would want to call. The former president has already ruled out the fact that he will testify, so that's not going to happen. It could be that they will try to call some constitutional scholars who do argue against the weight of constitutional scholar consensus that various aspects of this are unconstitutional. There's the claim in the president's brief that a former president cannot be tried in the Senate. Yes, so they could pull someone out to argue that point. There is even the claim that because the Chief Justice is not presiding, that somehow this is an illegitimate process, which is frankly ridiculous, because the reason that the Chief Justice presides over a trial of the current president is simply because the president of the Senate otherwise, who would be presiding, is the vice president, the very person who would benefit by assuming office if the president is convicted and removed. So the absence of the Chief Justice means absolutely nothing in this case when the presiding officer of the Senate has nothing to gain in terms of assuming office because the president has already left office.
But she is a Democrat, so assuming there were a tie, it could be argued she could break that tie.
Absolutely. There could be a role like that. But the constitutional issue that the founders realized was, if we have a trial of a sitting president and the president of the Senate is the vice president, we could have not just a political dynamic of whether they cast a vote or not, but we could have an issue where the vice president, in theory, conspires with senators to become president and has rulings from the presiding chair that helped to bring that into effect. The fact that the Chief Justice is not presiding in this case does not make it unconstitutional. It is merely a reflection of the fact that this trial is not of a president who is in office right now. But it is possible that the president's defense team could try to bring in some witnesses to argue this and other points, perhaps just to muddy the waters a bit. I don't know who else they would call to try to defend the president's actions, because there aren't too many people who are going to deny the words in the tweets were actually there, or to deny what the president said that day. The only wild card that could be there is if they find some experts on violence or on exhortation to violence that would claim that the words the president used are never used to prove incitement in a court of law. Of course, impeachment need not be a criminal offense. The fact that the House impeachment managers use the word incite in the impeachment article does match up with some criminal issues, but it need not be. They could simply say that the president fomented violence, and that whole argument would go away.
Jamie Raskin, who leads the impeachment team, called on President Trump, former President Trump himself, to testify, knowing perhaps full well that he would not accept. Why did Jamie Raskin do that? What was the purpose in calling President Trump to testify?
I suspect that there were two thoughts behind this. The first thought being that the president certainly likes to talk. The president does not like being told that something he did was wrong or improper. And perhaps publicly calling on him to testify just might goad him into doing so. And if so, that the president would be his own worst enemy on the stand. This is the reason why his lawyers fought furiously during the Mueller investigation, not to have him testify more and only to answer questions in writing, and in many of those give very limited answers. So I think maybe there was a slight hope that he would not be able to resist the urge to be in the public spotlight again, and in so doing, end up proving some of the points that the House impeachment managers are trying to make. But that is a long shot. So I suspect that the second thought is it can help to be a reference point in the trial. We do have a Fifth Amendment, which says you are not required to testify against yourself, but the Supreme Court has ruled in at least one case when it comes to non-criminal proceedings that a refusal to deny facts that are otherwise universally acknowledged, a refusal to deny facts could be taken into account as having an adverse effect on the mindset and the intention of someone. Now, Jamie Raskin has hinted that this is the case, that, and he, as a constitutional scholar, knows this, and he may bring that up in the trial itself, to bring up the fact that Donald Trump would not himself come here to deny the facts that we are asserting. Yes, his lawyers may push back on occasional things, but the fundamental facts of the case, what he tweeted, what he said, the phone call with the Georgia election official, and the events of January 6th themselves, the president is choosing not to show up to deny any of those facts. That shows something about the president's mindset. And it will be interesting to see how they argue that and how they bring that up in a way to try to fortify their case without giving too many openings to the president's defense, saying that they're attacking someone for exerting a fundamental right.
We know that senators want a short trial. Can Democrats make the effort worth it and also make their case quickly?
I believe they can. This is, as I mentioned, a relatively simple case as opposed to the previous impeachment of Donald Trump. And honestly, compared to the other presidential impeachments of Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, which involved more articles, which involved more evidence, this impeachment is a relatively quick one. The fundamental argument can be made in a matter of minutes. I think a more detailed argument can be made in a matter of hours. There is no need for days upon days of evidence and argumentation here. They may want to go into some of that, but the fact that they agreed to 16 hours and putting that limit on it suggests that they realize the value of a short, simple message rather than drowning the senators in detail. The issue of the short trial being good for the Senate because they have other business, including still some confirmations of many senior officials in the new administration, well, there's a reason that they're doing this trial only for part of a day. The Senate can continue some of its other business during this, and there's no doubt that if there is something urgent and important, they will merely schedule it for when the trial is not occurring. Does that mean that senators may have longer days than usual and that the poor, overworked staff of the senators will have very long days for the next week or two? Absolutely. But I don't think any of them would have it any other way when it is a matter of such import going on right now.
Do you really expect the trial to change any Republican senators' minds?
I can't say for sure. Experience tells me no, because our partisanship is so ingrained, and even something that used to be called the world's greatest deliberative body, the U.S. Senate, which used to have more independent-minded individuals, people who by the very structure of their election cycle had 6 years to consider things that were, you know, less subject to partisan back and forth. The Senate has changed. And the Senate is behaving much more like the House of Representatives traditionally has, and senators are not looking at the long view. So I want to say that they will fulfill the oath that they take to be an impartial jury. I suspect that many of them will not. This is a case, though, where because the Capitol itself was attacked and because lives were lost, that it will appear very insensitive at the very least to many of their own constituents back home, if they appear not to be even considering the facts. I argued back last year that this was also the case with the Ukraine impeachment because of the manipulation of the instruments of power by the president in order to secure his own electoral advantage. But that's a much harder case to make to voters across the United States. But if you have to go to your constituents and say, yes, you know, I realize that there was this incident at the Capitol, and yes, I realize that the president had a role in it, which many of them have acknowledged, but I think we should be able to vote him into office again and not disqualify him. There may be people even who normally are politically aligned with that senator who question that and say, you know, would you say the same thing if it was a president of another party? If it were a Democratic president, would you actually argue the same thing? And I think that potential hypocrisy is much more evident here than it would be in previous impeachments and is a thing that senators have to keep in mind when they have taken the oath to be impartial as they consider this impeachment.
What do you think are the consequences of not indicting the president?
Well, if they do not convict the president, there are two consequences. And I would say for the senators involved, they would have to imagine going back in their next election campaign, if they choose to have one, and they know they will be facing an opponent who will show what happened at the Capitol building and then will show that senator's vote not to convict the president. And yes, there may also be debates about marginal tax rates and immigration and other things, but I would love to be a political opponent of a senator who votes against conviction in this case because my campaign is relatively easy, which is this person here had the chance to say that this was wrong and take the punishment that the Constitution mandates for it and did not. It's an open and shut case, voters. So there's that consequence for the actual senators. That will not be true in every state because of our political dynamics, but at least in some places that will matter. The other consequence, of course, will be for the future. And I've been reading recently about the Roman Republic and what ultimately became the Roman Empire. And it's fascinating to me the importance of precedent in history. Once you break a norm or an institution, it becomes easier to break that norm in the future. And we have had a norm against political violence in the United States overall. And there have been exceptions. A senator, you know, caned inside the Senate chamber itself back in the 19th century. But we generally have upheld that institutions of government do not use physical violence on each other, and good for us. Well, back in the Roman Republic days, that norm was violated during one of the assemblies on the Hill when senators came with sticks and started beating people as they were trying to vote. And it was not the only cause of the future degradation of the Roman Republic, but it clearly broke that norm and made it easier for political violence to be used in years afterward. That is my fear of the consequence here. This has happened. We can't deny it happened. It has set a precedent already. But if a precedent is also set that the violence like we saw on January 6th absolutely cannot be tolerated and the other institutions of the U.S. government will take appropriate constitutional action against it, it will push it down as much as is still possible. Otherwise, I fear a consequence of letting this behavior go unpunished, if you will, from the person who's clearly wanted it to happen, would be that it opens the door for future presidents and future leaders to look at violence as an actual option in our political sphere, which is abhorrent and something that most reasonable people would agree we don't want to have here.
If impeachment doesn't work here, will it ever work?
It's an interesting question, Diane. And some representatives, and maybe some senators, but I've heard some representatives use exactly that question. If you do not impeach for this, what do you impeach for? Now, let's be fair. He was impeached for this. The House of Representatives, constitutionally and in a bipartisan fashion, did deem this impeachable behavior. That is done, that cannot be removed, and that is a constitutional remedy in and of itself that the founders had in mind. An impeachment is a serious matter. We tend to focus so much on the trial, so much on the convict or acquit, that we forget the fact that we have impeached a president and said this is clearly unacceptable behavior and it warrants removal from office, whether the other body of Congress chooses to do so or not. That is important. If you look at impeachment only as a vehicle to remove a president or to disqualify a president from future office, then you miss that. And then you look only at the consequence, when in fact the norm of calling out inappropriate behavior that rises to that constitutional standard of impeachment is also important. And I do not think we've lost that.
If this conviction fails, do you see former President Trump running for office again?
Yeah, that's the billion-dollar question, isn't it? It's hard to imagine him running again for several reasons. One is that he's lost the popular vote twice, and he lost it worse the second time than the first time. In fact, he lost it enough that even the Electoral College dynamics, which mediate that vote, could not keep him in the presidency. And we have seen nothing to indicate that he is more popular after the activities of January 6th and after leaving office. There is still polling to suggest that he is quite popular among what is left of the Republican Party, but that is not going to bring electoral success unless something dramatic changes. So I think rationally, running doesn't seem like a good idea because he would be so unlikely to win. And if there's anything that Donald Trump appears not to like, it's being publicly branded a loser. So offering up opponents the chance to prove a losing trend would seem like a bad idea. There's also the issue of, did he want to be president in the first place? Or did he want to get the attention that running for president would bring him? And somehow he actually won back 4+ years ago. Well, in that case, there's little to gain from running for president again. He already commands the public spotlight. If he were to come out today and call a press conference, as I mentioned earlier, every news network in the world would be covering that, and it would be headline news. And it will be for the next 4 years, regardless of what happens. Whether it should be or not, that is the dynamic. He is still the ultimate showman, and he can still pull strings even without running for president. So all of that suggests to me that he will not run for president again. But I have to say, it's really hard to get inside the heart and the mind of Donald Trump. I don't know what motivates his thinking at that level. And perhaps it's an irresistible urge to keep running and to be in the spotlight even more than he already has. Either way, however, it does freeze the Republican Party. If he says right now that he wants nothing to do with the future of the party, that he's not going to weigh in on future candidates, he himself will never run again, that could change that dynamic. But I don't see that happening. In all other possible worlds, Donald Trump essentially is the kingmaker because he still has such a high approval rating among Republican voters that anyone else who wants to run for president in 4 years has to sit back and wait to see what Donald Trump says and what Donald Trump does. And that leaves him in a very strong position with this party, unless they listen to the counsel of people like Adam Kinzinger and move away from the Trumpist part of their DNA. We shall see. I think the next year will be very telling because there will have to be some grassroots efforts and some ground organization for anyone who's going to be running for president to start building those pieces and thinking about it. And we may see some interesting developments based on both this impeachment trial and more so on how the Biden administration is going and what openings that offers for other people to challenge Trump within the party itself.
And final question, and this is a bit of a sidebar. Should President Biden, as he has suggested he may, deny Donald Trump access to intelligence briefings?
Absolutely. The motivation for presidents to offer to their predecessors intelligence briefings really relies on just a few factors. One of them is common courtesy, is just saying, we realize that you are a person of importance, a former president, and it's just a nice thing to do. You already have legally provided help with an office and staff and security, so we'll give you these two. But frankly, that is not the strongest reason why former presidents get intelligence briefings. The main reason is because former presidents are sometimes called upon by the person in the Oval Office for frank advice, because very few people know what it's actually like to be in that chair. So even someone like Richard Nixon, who almost certainly would have been impeached and removed had he not resigned, left Washington in disgrace. Most presidents who followed him, including Bill Clinton famously, called upon Richard Nixon for advice, particularly on Russia and China. Those former presidents can give advice without having access to regular intelligence briefings, but it certainly makes it much more useful to the current president if they have some ground truth that can be established by being kept up to date on what's going on. Imagine Russia in 1974, when Richard Nixon left office, as opposed to the early 1990s when Bill Clinton was calling him for advice. So much had changed that the Soviet Union didn't even exist anymore. So it is useful to the president for that reason. And frankly, it also matters because former presidents travel overseas. And when they travel overseas, even if they are not in any way a representative of the U.S. government, foreign populations and governments still see them as representative of the U.S. government. And on occasion, they are used to pass messages or as emissaries. Jimmy Carter famously has played this role a couple of times. If you're going to use a former president in that role, or if you even want to have them available for the possibility, giving them access to intelligence briefings makes sense. Now, all of that logic is gone with Donald Trump. Joe Biden is not going to call Donald Trump for advice on national security and foreign policy affairs. He has several other presidents that he can call upon and certainly would well before he would ever call Donald J. Trump. He is not going to use Donald Trump as an emissary or to pass any messages overseas. In fact, he probably hopes that Donald Trump does not go overseas and complicate anything that the administration is doing. The issue that will probably give Joe Biden the minimal hesitation, and only this, is the courtesy and the tradition. It has not been a tradition for all of American history because we simply haven't had intelligence briefings for presidents until the modern era. But it is a tradition, and Joe Biden is somewhat of a traditionalist, somewhat of an institutionalist. And I don't think in the abstract he likes the idea of not doing something that decades of his predecessors have done. I think that would bother him in the abstract. In the individual case of Donald Trump, though, there is no reason to suggest that it would be of benefit to Joe Biden as president. And there is reason to suspect that it actually could be dangerous for the country because Donald Trump has shown, let's say, a willingness to be cavalier with classified information while president, and no indication that he would do otherwise as a former president.
David, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
That was David Priest. He's Chief Operating Officer at the Lawfare Institute, a senior fellow at the Michael B. Hayden Center for Intelligence at George Mason University, and author of How to Get Rid of a President. And that's all for today. Thanks to those who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Please stay well, stay safe. I'm Diane Reams.